The following session of Radios and Tunnels contains a few choice expletives due to the passionate nature of the conversation. So if you're easily offended by the occasional or perhaps a then by all means, adjust your listening expectations and all-around reception strategy for this particular session accordingly.
Radios and Tunnels.
That song is called Crack at Dawn. It's by Paul and the Tall Trees, and it was released back in 2016 on Big Crown Records. Man, I love that song. I love a lot of the Paul and the Tall Trees songs, as you're going to learn over the next hour or so. I'm Jeff Skinwade, and you're listening to Radios and Tunnels. And today's session is a family affair, because not only do I have Paul Shalda of Paul and the Tall Trees in studio with me, I also have his dad, William Shalda. And I think this is one hell of a story. Paul traveled the world with Charles Bradley, the great soul singer, as his guitarist and backup singer. But the seed that was planted for Paul to grow into that musical persona that he is was planted by his dad, William, who had dreams of being a doo-wop star in the mid-60s. Well, a very standard tale is a musician finds a woman, falls in love, marries her, they start a family, and he leaves his musical dreams behind so he can provide for his family. But what he really provided was a musical education that his three boys soaked in. Now let's circle back a couple decades later, and those three boys pulled their dad back in to record a fantastic album under the name The Shaladas. Released on Daptone Records, Love in the Wind is a doo-wop album, but it's also a soul album. Little bit of folk, little bit of psychedelia, and really, really cool. It sounds timeless. It's one of the best summer records of the year, if you ask me. Great music to listen to out at the lake and sip on a cold beer. And when I reached out to Paul and said, "Hey man, I need you to join me on my podcast," he said, "Hey, my dad just moved here. Can he join us too?" And man, that was one hell of a suggestion. You're a recent Dallas resident, if I have that right.
Yeah, probably within the week, yeah. I don't know that you get much more recent than that.
Uh-huh. No, and I met your son, Paul, first. Paul joining us in studio as well.
Hi, how are you?
All the way from originally Staten Island, where, Paul, you grew up with your dad, William, teaching you all about music. And I would imagine that was a cool experience to have a papa bear that had released records and had as much love for music as your dad does.
Yeah, kind of amazing. I know you have a son. It kind of takes a little while to come around to that thing. Early on, you know, he just sang to us, and so that's what I knew of it. I had no idea that he had a record, a 45 out in 65, I can't even tell you, up until probably I was in my teens when I was collecting records myself. So yeah, it's kind of phenomenal. I'm a lucky guy.
What were you listening to in your teens when your dad dropped a doo-wop record on you? Which we'll play a little bit of in a second, by the way. We'll get everybody a taste of that.
There's a lot of stuff happening then. I mean, Wu-Tang came out in, what, 94?
Yes.
94? I mean, I'm a Staten Island guy. That was what, I mean, I was in a different scene, a rock and roll hardcore scene that strangely enough, you know, it was all about 45, 7 inches is what we were calling them. And so it had this weird record vibe thing happening with what is going on now, and also with the older, like, records and the labels that I deal with now, with Daptone and Big Crown and stuff like that. But in my teens, it was a lot of Wu-Tang, a lot of hardcore stuff, Minor Threat and stuff like that. And and some hip hop, some New York hip hop, really. Like that was kind of it between those things. A lot of the hardcore cats, man. I mean, Wu-Tang took over when I was a teenager for me. So it was like it ripped right through it.
It would be impossible, I think, to be a young person growing up in New York and at least not, I don't want to say love hip hop, but at least have it be a part of your life. And so, William, you grew up on the soul scene. What are you kind of thinking about what your kids are listening to in the 80s and 90s?
I love it. I thought it was great. I mean, and even the hip hop, I mean, hip hop actually, I thought, had a lot in common with doo-wop. in that the beauty of doo-wop and the early rock and roll was that it was accessible. You know, you didn't need a lot. And with doo-wop, I mean, we went out on the street corner and we just sang. We did 4 or 5 part harmony until somebody threw hot water on us or something else. And, you know, we were trying to emulate groups like the Moonglows. And the Moonglows, I remember my mother complaining to me. She said, oh, what are you listening to these guys? They sound like cats on a backyard fence. And that's exactly what they did. But they strive to do it. If you ever, I don't know if you ever listened to the Moonglows ever, but these Harvey Fuqua, Bobby Lester endings were like, wah, 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 and it was designed to sound like that. So anyway, the accessibility of that, just, and the music kind of morphed and got more sophisticated, and all of a sudden you came out with hip-hop, and the guys were just, one guy going,
yeah,
and you were back to basics again. Where you didn't have to strap up with $8,000 worth of equipment, you
right?
Know? So,
right.
So I loved it. It was the excitement. It was the energy. It was beautiful. I thought it was great.
What do you remember, Paul, listening to? Like, because I have specific memories of what my parents listened to, what my older sister listened to when I wasn't choosing my own records. So at some point, you know, like you said, Minor Threat, you're gonna start picking your own stuff. But before you're doing that, what do you remember hearing around your folks' house?
Oh, they had a ton of records. Pop would, he'd play a lot of Beatles because he had us singing harmonies from the get go.
Really,
it was a great way to shut up three boys in the back of the car. You know what I mean? You have three boys in the back of the car, 10, 8, and 6, 8, 6, and 4, and you're just like, stop.
You guys would sing "Love on an Elevator."
And
by Aerosmith?
That was one of my first tapes.
And Jenny's got a gun. There was some nice harmonies in some of those songs.
One of my first tapes was Permanent Vacation. That was 80s style. That was not teens. Mm-hmm. I was probably eight or nine when that record came out.
But that's the whole idea is keeping you guys quiet.
Yeah. So. No, you guys did a great job of that. But their records in like their style, they were hippies. You know what I mean? They had all the greats, all the classics. You could imagine. Name them. It's kind of straight down the line. A lot of James Taylor. Pop was a big James Taylor fan.
So right.
A lot of James Taylor. Tom Waits. You know, Beatles and some Stones and some Zeppelin and. You know, just the regular, you know, basically across the board classic stuff they had there. Pop would sing us Cat Stevens at night and Beatles songs, so that was kind of engraved. That was when we were real young at like, you know, 6, 4, and 2, and I can remember hearing you sing that stuff to sleep super young.
So. And like you mentioned, James Taylor and Cat Stevens, you almost in some ways kind of do a modern version of that, but it's also interesting to me because production-wise it has a timeless kind of sound. But where are you? Oh, sorry. Are you the oldest, the youngest,
the middle guy?
Okay, so you're
the middle son.
Yeah. And we'll talk about the Shalados in a minute because ultimately the three boys get back together with their dad and you guys do a doo-wop record. And I really could not believe what I was hearing when I heard it. But we're going to get to that in a minute. But with the Paul and the Tall Trees stuff, how do you get to that point through your journey in music to where that's the style of music that you're making and that's what you want to sound like?
It's tough. You know, I mean, I started when I thought about it today. I started, what, 25 years ago. My first record came out in 1994.
Really?
Three steps up.
1994. I have a 45. 19, with me and my older brother, Will. That was our first 45.
What is the style of music?
That's like hardcore, melodic hardcore thing.
Okay.
Happened in 94.
Yeah.
And I was 16. I was 16.
Were you that old?
I was 16. I think I was 15 when we tracked it.
Where did you track it?
We tracked it at a friend TJ Quatron's house onto eight track tape at the time.
So was it like drums and guitar? Because you're a guitar player.
Yeah, well, at the time I was just a singer.
Okay.
At the time I was just a singer. I've always done the singing thing. I picked up the guitar. My pop told me, he explains it best, that the guitar is kind of backup. It's accompaniment for the vocals. And that's kind of the way I look at it. I'm not a trained guitarist. I've never went to school for guitar. If you ask me the chords I'm playing in my songs, most likely I could tell you a couple and then I'm lost. You know what I mean? So I just taught myself, and it was really just there because I was writing these melodies. Eventually I stopped just singing and I was like, I want to write my own stuff. I want to kind of try this thing out, and it morphed. It morphed. Like our first record I did, as a solo artist kind of has this sound, and then the next record has a little bit different. We record the next record at Levon Helms' place, which is super nice. I got to hang out with Levon Helms.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I got to hang out with Levon Helms, smoke some shit with Levon
Helms.
How
did that happen?
All my life, I kind of stepped into some shit, you know what I mean? I got to be honest, I just lucked out. I knew of friends, people who were just connected with these other artists were into what I was doing, even though I wasn't on a big scale, and I've never really been on a big scale. Just the people that knew these people were into the music that I did, and so the drummer who worked with Levon at his place, he was a fan, and he recorded drums on it. We recorded at the studio at Levon's house, and
wow,
yeah, kind of nuts, man, just to hang out with that guy, you know. I've only met one other guy like him, and that was Charles. I mean, I always thought about this. Like, I met Levon, and he had this smile, and when you hang out with him in a room, all you could do is smile and, like, just be happy, you know, just kind of feel this love. And the only other guy I ever met like that was Charles, man. It was like he had the same aura, the same spirit. It was kind of awesome. I'm very, very, very grateful. But so it kind of morphed into that, and then I started getting into some other kinds of styles, and I've always just tried to change my vocal style a bit, just to kind of, for my own sanity and to not be bored, to try to go here and there and whatever. And so, yeah, and then I got into this record. But Tommy and I, like, with the last Paul and the Tall Trees and this record, we were pretty adamant about keeping it to 8 tracks and just trying to make that whole thing happen.
Hope you feel my love when I'm not around. Hope it makes its way across the sea. Or maybe the wind will carry the sound of my voice to the hills of Italy.
How did you teach your boys to sing, or were they born with the gift?
It's a combination. I mean, you can't teach someone to sing if they don't have the capacity. I mean, if you ever heard somebody, you know, who's got a tin ear, you can teach them, hey, there's a melody over here. They may appreciate it very well, but if they can't hear it and then coordinate their vocal cords to hit the note they got to hit, you're not going anywhere with
that's
it.
That's the Skin Wade story. I'm a mess. I wish I could sing. I can't. I mean, I can't organize it in my head to do what you're describing. When did you know? I was like, dude, my boys can sing.
When they would sing along or hum along with songs. And then, you know, I mean, it almost started with Sesame Street songs. They'd be singing along with those things. And one of the first songs we sang in harmony was the old, I can only sing the high part. It's right. I can only sing the low part, you know, and they just did all these things. Yeah. And
I don't even remember.
And it was just great sitting on the stoop. Yeah, but you were maybe 8 at the oldest. Maybe you were 7 and Carmine was 5 and Will was 9. I don't know. But you guys were doing it. And then we just tool around town in this really light lime green old beat up Cadillac that we used to have. And they would sing along with all these Beach Boys songs. And then every now and then I'd throw on a Muddy Waters tape. And it was like, how do we sing along with this?
The harmony's here.
That's right.
Just feel the grit.
What do you
feel
the grit, kids. Exactly.
Hear that this is what real life is like.
Kids. This is what real life is like.
Spoiled.
I want to get to the Shalada story because I find this so interesting. There's so many things that intrigue me about this because, you know, like people... I'm a little bit older than Paul, or I'm a lot older, but, you know, I arrived at older music through hip-hop, not through my parents' record collection, because my parents weren't big music heads, but hip-hop brought me back to, then I became a soul collector and a jazz collector and all this stuff, and that's how you discover the Daptones, and hey, there's a modern thing going on, and they're using old analog recording techniques to grab a certain sound, but I was so taken by your stuff, the Paul and the Tall Tree stuff. Because I did not expect it. And actually, you know, we had a bunch of mutual connections before we actually met up, Paul.
Right.
And it's amazing to me that you're a Maverick fan that whole thing. But crazy. I met you through our friends at Josie Records. And you met my friend Adrian Quesada down in Austin and on and on.
Yeah,
but when I finally heard your stuff, I was really, quite honestly, I was sort of stunned by it. Because it's not what I thought. I would love to hear your description of what Paul and the Tall Trees is. Style-wise.
That's tough. I mean, I think what I try and tell people is that, you know, it's rock and soul. It's kind of different. It's an acquired taste. I know my vocals are an acquired taste. I understand that. It's not that I do that on purpose. I think it takes a long time to be able to say that's me. I know, you know, you have influences all your life and you end up trying to sound like your influences and, or just sounding like them because it just happens. And so for me, it's tough to describe other than rock and soul, classic rock.
There's a folk element.
Yeah, there is a folk element to it. Some people have said there's a country
Bohemian.
Element.
Yeah.
I think it would be a total shortchange to call it folk.
Right.
And part of it is because of, you know, the production approach.
Right.
But part of it is there's a big sphere of influence going on. But,
right. You listen to React or Crack at Dawn. That's not folk.
No, I started the podcast off with Crack at Dawn because it's so unique to me. And even like the way you get into the initial verse, there's like a stutter thing going on where you're trying to find your footing. That's almost bluesy in some regard.
Yeah, it kind of has a Lennon vibe, like a well vibe or something like that, where it's just kind of written around the vocal melody, and then the guitar is like, all right, this is what I should play around this vocal melody kind of thing.
And the groove is super cool. The production's cool. I want to get into some of your new stuff. And before we're going to play Someone Is Someone, and you brought up Charles. And we should. Before we tell that story, we need to tell the listeners because we didn't. We just made an assumption here. Yeah. Tell them who Charles is and what he was to you.
Charles Bradley was a soul singer. Was a great man who took me around the world for 4 years. He let me have the best seat in the house. Watch him do his thing every night.
Did you play guitar for him?
Or? I did. I played guitar and I sang backing vocals. He was a great man. He was a truly, truly great man, and he helped me out in so many ways and opened my eyes to so many things so he's a soul artist who just has like I said about Levi, just had that thing. I mean, I've never seen people at shows before with these smiles on their face looking at this man telling this terribly heartbreaking story, so happy for this man. And I had the best seat. I had the best seat in the house. Like, it was just, he was so mesmerizing. I tell people, like, I could set myself on fire on stage and nobody would look over at me. Nobody would try and help me. They would just say, get that guy off the fucking stage.
Smoke distracting us from Charles.
Smoke scared in my eyes. I mean, he just had that thing, and I got and he let me ride along. He let me ride along with him.
And I saw you guys perform last week, and before you performed Someone to Someone off of the new record that has not been released yet, you said this was Charles's song.
Yeah.
And so my first thought was, well, why are you just now recording it? And how long have you had this song? And I immediately had all these questions, and it's a great song.
Thanks.
So give me the story about Someone to Someone, and then we'll play it.
Someone to Someone was written while we started doing the Shalada thing. Tommy and I were talking about doing the Shalada thing. We were trying to get Pop to do doo-wop songs. We were begging him, Pop, to doo-wop songs, to doo-wop songs. And it took him a little while. It took a little coaxing. And I was on the road with Charles for probably about a year and a half at this time. And when I came home back to New York, I would do some writing for the new Paul and Tall Trees record or for the Shalada record.
How long ago was this?
This was a while ago. This was like 2014, 15.
Okay.
And so I came home and I had this melody. I was like walking around New York City and I'm like, I don't know, you know, like I met all these wonderful people around the world, and in New York in my home, I just couldn't find the person. I felt like I'm not, just not for me here. Like that person for me is not here. So I went home, I talked to Pop, and I'm like, man, I got this hook. I want to take a listen to it. I got this hook going into this verse, and I played it for him. I am someone to someone, but no one to nobody, and it's not like a prophet. You know, and I gave it to him, and I said, go with it. Go do your thing. Like, go, like, let's make a Shalada song. Let's make a Shalada song. And he, the next day, he sent a demo out to me and Tommy with the whole, like, he took the story. He's like, Paul, that's your story. Like, that's your story. Like, that's for you. Like, that's it. Like, and so we recorded it as for the Shalada record. It was supposed to be on the Shalada record, and it just didn't fit. It felt more like a Paul and the Tall Trees thing, and so it was like it fit so well with the record that we had just recorded for Paul and the Tall Trees. And by the time we got around to recording it, you know what I mean? It's 2017, you know, it was around then. So it kind of just all it just fit into the Paul and the Tall Trees. And to get into it, why Charles loved it so much is because when we right before, you know, one of the tours with Charles, I would open a couple of the shows and I would play it, and he'd be like, "Oh, I love that song! I play that song, man! You gotta play that song!" And then every time I was on the road with him from then, he would ask me to play it during his set, and I'd be like, "Charles, I can't play this song, man! It's like your set. I'm not. Nobody wants. I told you, I can set myself on fire on stage. Nobody cares. No one wants to hear me sing. Like, I love you. Like, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it to myself. I'm not doing it to you. Like, it's not happening." But he would try and sing it every time in the bus, and he would just be like, "I'm somebody, nobody. Nobody, somebody. Paul, what? Paul, how's that go?"
Starts making up his own song.
Absolutely unique. Ah, man, absolutely
give him a big
unique.
Fucking hug. Give him a noogie.
The one song is Someone to Someone. It's beautiful, and it sounds like this.
I am someone to someone, but no one, nobody here. I am someone, someone, but no one, nobody here. And it's not like a prophet could make the message more clear. I've been wandering the desert for 40 long years, no sight for sore eyes or music to my ears. I know somewhere to someplace I could call home. I keep on searching, still I'm alone. I am someone to someone, but no one to nobody here. I am someone to someone, but no one to nobody is. And it's not like nobody could make that message more clear. All the courtesies any man could I extend, but never am I certain of any friend. I have women to talk to, but still I'm afraid. I'm like a spectator at life's parade.
I love that song. Everyone, I love the whole new record. I'm not bragging that I've gotten to hear it yet, and you guys haven't, but I'm sort of bragging that I've got to hear it, and you guys haven't. But you're going to love it. And I think it's kind of an interesting segue to kind of circle back more to some of William's story here. because you mentioned that you thought this might be a Shaladah song, but it became a Paul and the Tall Tree song. But the Shaladahs don't happen if it's not for, what, the Monterey's back in the 60s?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're about to play some of that, but before we do that, take me back to what William Shalda is doing in the early 1960s, trying to figure out how he's going to put out a record.
Well, in the 1960s, and I probably began singing this stuff just because 54, 55, 56, you have Cleftones, Frankie Lyman, and the Teenagers, the Flamingos, the Moonglows, the Penguins, all these groups. So you just get involved in it, and everybody in Brooklyn is singing doo-wops on the corner. So around 1960, 61, I'm singing with my group, which is called the Fluorescents, and there's this other group called the Monterey's, and they're pretty good, you know, and, I know I got my own group, but I'd like to be with these guys. And the biggest honor, we were in New Utrecht High School, and the biggest honor is to sing in the bathroom, in the boys' bathroom in the cafeteria, because that's where the tile was and gave you a natural reverb.
Oh, nice. Yes, man. Yeah.
And as it turned out, the second tenor for the Monterey's did not go to New Utrecht High School. So they needed a fill-in. And I just happened to be cutting out of every class I had to sing in the cafeteria. And I hooked up with them then. And, I mean, that was all there was to it. At that point, they switched out second tenors.
And, how old were you when this came out?
When the record came out?
When you were 45,
let's see. It was probably my fourth time as a sophomore. Yeah, I went through high school really on the long-term plan.
Yeah.
I actually went to summer school every year deliberately so I could sing in the different schools, like Erasmus High School. There's a song by Kenny Vance and the Planetones called Looking for an Echo, and it's true because it's about singing in Erasmus Hall High School. They had this huge hallway that just echoed like crazy. It was mm-hmm. It was terrific. So anyway, we're all singing there, and it turns out that one guy has a connection with someone who's actually producing records and writing songs. So all of a sudden, instead of doing our own copies of doo-wops of everybody else's stuff, along comes a songwriting team of Bobby Lance and Fran Robbins. They were brother and sister. They also wrote The House that Jack Built for Aretha Franklin.
Wow.
So, you know, they came up with these two great sides. Unfortunately, Fran Robbins was billed as Fred Robbins, eternal regrets.
Terrible.
But so we recorded those songs, got some traction in California, perhaps because the name of the group was the Monterey's and mm-hmm. you know, Monterey. But we had the great misfortune to be doing some nice soul doo-wop type of stuff when the Beatles came out.
Right.
And
the British invasion.
Yeah, the whole thing. And I mean, the Beatles themselves had, I think, 14 of the top 20 at the time. They knocked everybody out. Everybody was gone. Right. You know, you try a couple of different configurations. You pick up a guitar. You start playing a guitar. I just said the only way I'm going to be able to sing is to sing my kids to sleep at night. Because, you know, I mean, once I got married and had the guys, you know, your whole perspective changes.
Absolutely.
I wasn't going to stop singing or getting into music, because if you're into music, you know you never get rid of it.
Right.
But I said, well, okay, I'm going to sing. I'm going to keep my chops by singing to them. And that's where I got into these other guys like James Taylor or even some of the more acoustic Rolling Stones stuff like Prodigal Son or things like that, because you could sing kids to sleep with that. Some Dylan stuff, Desolation Row. I mean, really stark, bizarre lyrics, but it was singing them to sleep. It was
I didn't know what you were saying.
Although Paul wouldn't go to sleep.
Right.
Will and Carmine would go to sleep. Paul would be up for 2.5 hours.
Sounded good,
do
man.
Another one, Dad. Do another one.
Well, the good thing about all that is before you went to that part of life, you did get some recordings done.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And we're going to listen to Step Right Up, which you take the lead vocal on.
Yes, sir.
And that is from the Monterey's 1965, and it went a little something like this.
I myself of you. Yes, I will. And
Man, so hearing the story and listening to that, someone like me that grew up and lived my whole life in Dallas, that's the sort of stuff I see in like nostalgic movies about New York. You know what I'm saying? Like the whole idea of the doo-wop group on the corner and hearing music like that. I mean, I've only experienced that sort of thing through film, and we certainly didn't have that environment down here. So it's really cool to hear that, and it's really special that you guys circled back so many years later and made a doo-wop record. And I got to say this, man. I don't listen to doo-wop. That's not a regular part of what I listen to. Me and my wife wore y'all's record out.
Wow.
And I think part of it is, you know, the uniqueness of the sound. I think knowing that you're a family that did this so many years after, there's a timeless quality to it. It's fun knowing that it was recorded in modern times. There's so many things to like about this. But before we play a little bit of the record, I want to know what you were thinking, William, when your boys came in and said, "Pops, we got to do a doo-wop group."
Yeah, it was, the interesting thing was, before that happened, they came to me and said, and let me back up a few steps. Charles Bradley's producer, Tom Brennick, is an old friend of Paul's and an old friend of Carmine's and an old friend of Will's. I mean, back from high school, maybe even from elementary school, I don't know. But they stayed in touch over all the years. Mm-hmm. And he came up one day and he said, "Geez, you know, I need some backing vocals for a Charles Bradley record for Victim of Love. You think you guys could come in and just kind of fool around? I heard that you guys fool around a little bit." Yeah. And this was really like his, you know, his brainchild. So we come in and we start singing the backing vocals, you know, just kind of made them up on the spot. I said, "Well, what do you think? Can you do something like this?" And we said, "Well, how about, you know," and that whole thing. And he just loved it. And within a week, he was like, "You know, we got to do a record." You know? And that's when Paul started, "You got to do a doo-wop record." Yeah. And meanwhile, I had kind of morphed away from that because what I had been doing with them had been, you know, playing the guitar a little bit more. So it was a little bit more Dylan-esque. And again, I got kind of heavily into the blues. I wasn't kidding with the Muddy Waters stuff.
Yeah, you wanted to be a blues guy.
I love Muddy Waters.
Like, man, you're a corporate lawyer. You can't be a blues guy, man.
That's my alter ego.
You work in mutual funds.
Guys as corporate security lawyer.
You don't have the blues, man.
You're right. I don't have the blues.
You're doing well.
So I said, "Gee, I don't know if I can do this." And I started it, and it just seemed as though I must have had such a reservoir of it built up over the years that it just, you know, it just really came right out like it had been there all along. But I have to say that the songs on the album I think that are the best are the ones that are co-authored with Paul and with Tom. Because, you know, like even as Paul was talking about with Someone to Someone, great hook. Somebody else can do another finishing part of it or whatever. If you do the whole thing, it almost sounds, I don't want to say incestuous, but, you know, it's just too much the same.
Right, right. Yeah.
But if you get 2, 3, 4 different people having some input into it, all of a sudden you can go into some nice places and there's a nice, I know you refer to it as a doo-wop album. I'm not certain that it is exactly that. It's got so much other soul aspects to it.
Right. Yeah,
so much soul, psychedelia. Yeah. Some of the comments I've seen about it, people comparing us to the Young Rascals and stuff like that, which is, you know, I love to hear, you know. But I mean, it's the record itself. It's not just us. And Tommy clearly is the fifth one of us, Tommy Brennick.
Well, let's hear Open My Eyes, for example. I want to know how this song came to be, what the recording aspect of it was like, what was the impetus for all this. Explain this to me, and then we'll listen to it.
I can remember Tommy came to me with this piano part, and I got this tune, and what do you think? And I kind of laid down the Open My Eyes thing to it, you know, the melody and everything with it kind of going along with the piano part, and like, all right, we're gonna get Pop to work on the lyrics, you know. Kind of that's how when the three of us wrote together, it was like Tommy would do the music, I would do like the hook melody and the verse melody, and then we would just give it to Pop for the lyrics because he just and all the harmonies behind it because he just nails it. And so we did that with this one, and then we had the the chorus was, we had like three different parts for the chorus, and I eventually came up with the part for the chorus with the injuries, everything's cool. And it ended up becoming a duet, actually. This is the only song on the record that is a duet, actually. It's just me and Pop. Which is crazy. And Tommy did the backwards guitar thing on it, man. It just kind of came along that way.
That's why I say it goes a long way from doo-wop when you get backwards tape loops.
It's right. Awesome, man.
Well, that's also what makes it more than just a reimagining of a long-lost genre album. It becomes something that's modern, even though it has a timeless sound. This is Open My Eyes. Of this album, on the Shalada's album, did you guys have an idea going in of, all right, we need to have it sound like this? Did you have a vision going in, or did it just sort of take its own shape?
I gotta take this one, man. Pop did demos, and honestly, like, you know, you go into the studio, you know, you hang out with this band, the Menahan Street Band.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal band.
Yes.
They're the band.
Yes.
The band on this record. They are the band record.
And who are some of the names?
So we have Homer Steinweiss, we have Nick Mavshon, we have Leon Michaels, we have Victor Axelrod.
Yeah.
Victor Axelrod. Yeah. So people that don't know, Victor Axelrod is the dude that came up with the keyboard lick that you've heard a million times on the Amy Winehouse song Rehab.
Yeah.
And Homer is the drum for the Daptone sound. Yeah. And when Amy Winehouse wanted to be Amy Winehouse, you know, it's like, let's go get that band, and they were the backing band for the big part
Tommy's
of her
on
record.
The guitar on almost of that record, that Amy.
They back so many people. It's almost like they're the Booker T and the MGs of this genre. Right.
If so, Stax is the thing with the house band of the MGs.
So leading into this, right? So that's the band that's recording this stuff. And Pop comes in with his demos, and Pop records the bass, the drums, the organ, the guitar, and all the vocals on it. It's like, you know, it's like Billy Wilson. It's like, you know, he is the guy. It's like, you know, it's a little Brian Wilson. And so he comes in, and you have guys like Homer and Nick just being like, I'm gonna play exactly that. And on the record, you're hearing these guys
just doing what your dad did. That's great.
It's amazing. And they love it. And they love it's just so real. It's so right.
But they do it so much better.
They do it so much better.
They are so
but
crisp
it's
and
right
tight.
Their work on that, Tommy's production on that record. Yeah. I mean, just grateful for that whole experience.
It's such a labor of love. I mean, it took years to do it.
It is a labor of love for him.
Yeah.
It is a family member.
Yeah.
It's time we said goodbye. Just
I just, the greatest thing to me ever. I mean, this is the most wonderful experience of my life. Recording a record with your kids.
I
hope I get to do that one day.
I could jump out this window right now and die. And it'd be okay because.
But don't do that. We don't need any violence on the podcast.
Come on.
Seems like there a very aggressive thing to do.
But you know what, though? We might sell a couple extra records.
Oh, my Lord. It's the.
You can't say I died at 27, though. You can reverse the
27
digits.
27 is the year.
You can reverse the digits.
27 is the year you're supposed 72. To die. That is one of the things about this. It's so unique. You know, I was talking to my buddy KT earlier. He came out to the show on Friday. And it was you two, and then you guys had
and a backing vocalist,
right?
Yeah, great.
And so it was a four piece with musical accompaniment. It was just Paul, you on the guitar, and then your buddy on the keys.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me as I'm watching this is it's first of all, the Kessler Theater has great sound, so I feel like it captured all the nuance of what you guys were doing. But you were talking earlier, Paul, about people hearing stuff or people having a chance to hear stuff. And I'm sitting there watching this going, the Fleet Foxes are great and they're popular, but I can't see why someone would enjoy that and not be blown away by this. And the whole aspect of the story of your recording with your dad and your dad is here with you in frickin' Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And y'all are doing a show together. Right. My wife said the same thing. It touched us.
It
gave an extra layer to the performance to make me connect to the songs and the sound. And it's just it's a beautiful thing.
I mean, I've since I started doing my solo stuff, I've always had Pop on every. He's been on every record.
Yeah.
He's been on every single record, whether it's playing harmonica or singing or playing lead guitar. He's been on every single record that goes back to 2004.
Okay, well, then I want to do this. I want to talk about, the first song I heard by you, Paul, was Once in a While. And if I think, wasn't there a video for
there
that?
There was a video.
And it was a black and white video.
We did a little video there right on the Queen in Queens. It was in Long Island City.
Yeah. My buddy.
I don't know if it was black and white, but there was a mime in it.
Yes.
There was a mime in it.
Yeah.
That's Leps. He runs Big Crown.
Oh, okay.
With Leon. Leon
and he has a whole stable of mimes.
It's fantastic.
Is Leon of the L. Michaels Affair? Leon? Okay. Yeah. So anyways, my buddy Will over at Josie Records told me about you. He's a fantastic human. And he was telling me about you. I was like, I need to check his stuff out. And so I went online first before I went to Spotify or anything. I saw that video. And I was like, oh, this is really, really interesting. I like this. This is not what I expected at all. So I want to play that song. But before I do it, I want to hear your dad tell me what his thoughts are of the song, what he thinks about the song.
About this song?
Yeah.
First of all, I love the song. I love the stuff that Paul writes, all of it. But there's a hook in there that he had me do in the background.
Yeah.
Have mercy, have mercy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pure impressions.
A little Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah. I mean, and I said, wow, this is great. Told me later on that he originally wrote it for the Shaladas.
That was the Shaladas. That was the first Shaladas song. I was like, Pop, we got to do this song. And I told you, he's still wanting to be a blues man. And I was like, Pop, we have to do this. This is a Shaladas song, man. Let's do this song. I'm into this other stuff. And I was like, all right, then I'm taking it for my record.
Well, I love how sonically gentle it is. I love the simplicity and the beauty of it. And I promise you, this song will pop up in your head again a week from now, and you won't even know why. It's from Paul and the Tall Trees. It's Once in a While.
Once in a while, occasionally lately, once in a while, once in a while, never again. Okay, well, maybe, once in a while, once in a while, what could I say? I thought our love was more. Once in a while, once in a while, I lose it. So have mercy on me. Go easy. Have mercy on me. Go easy with my heart.
once in a while. Occasionally lately, once in a while, once in a while, never again. Okay, well maybe, once in a while, once in a while, what could I say? I thought I was bona fide, but to my surprise. So have mercy, on me, Louise. Have mercy on me, Louise. Have mercy on me, Louise. Have mercy on me.
I love that song. My wife loves that song. We love that song together. I think you should go love that song all the time as well. Paul and the Tall Trees, Big Crown record. So that was the first record. That was 2016?
Correct, yeah.
Came out in 2016. Get a copy, or if you're a Spotify type, you can stream it there. But it's a really, really cool record. But I was bragging earlier that I had heard the new record. Now, the song we're going to play here is actually currently on Spotify. You can go listen to it now. I saw you guys perform it live last week, and it has, it feels epic. It's powerful. It's got a lot of emotion, I feel like. I mean, I wasn't, I haven't talked to you about this song.
Yeah.
But I feel the power of this song. And I certainly felt it seeing it live. And so I want you to tell me about Although We Cry, why you wrote it, what's it about, and why it was the first single on the new record.
This song was written, right after I came out of a long relationship. There's this record was written basically, you know, for the most part around this pretty intense, long distance relationship. Being on the road for a couple of years, and it was great. I'm so grateful for this experience, to have loved so deeply and to have felt this way. It's the greatest thing in the world, and so it's just when you get through the tough stuff. I mean, everyone can relate to this. It doesn't have to be about love. It really doesn't. It could be about anything you're in life, and that you learn from it. And when you have that moment when you're crying and you're just like laughing at the same time about, I cannot believe I have been so lucky to have been through this, and what it feels so real when you're doing it, and then you come down and it's like, that's okay, I'm here and everything's safe and everybody's all right, and you know, and we tried, and we really did, we tried, and it doesn't work, and so that's okay, and we learn, you know, it hurts, we learn, and you know, and then you grow, you know, you experience, you learn and you evolve, you know, like that's how it goes. And if you don't evolve, you're going to go through the same experience. So again, if you don't learn, you're not going to evolve, and then you're going to go through the same experience again. There's steps, you got to do these steps. And that is kind of how that song happened. It had happened after I'd really been upset for a long time. And then I'd finally come out of that and been like, how grateful am I? To have felt that way about another human being in this world, and I think we can all feel that way. Or how grateful am I to have been through this experience and what I learned from it? Or how grateful am I to have done any of these things and to be alive now? You know? And so that's kind of what it's about, and that's kind of what the whole record is based about. It's about that relationship.
Although we cry, I
not that it sounds like it, or not that I get that. I just get a similar sort of monumental, sweeping feeling that I get from the Paul Simon song "Only Living Boy in New York," where there's just this spirit that picks you up with that. And I think part of it is the song clearly is a powerful song, the way it's recorded. All of those elements make it a pretty damn perfect song. Now we know so to it's really great.
I had to put it as the first song on the record. It just feels so right for me. Like the piano in the beginning, it does. It did the same thing for me when we tracked it. I thought that, and we had done it live, and the acoustic guitar and the vocals are on one track, so you can't, you know, that's why you hear me talk during it a little bit, and you can't, you know, the instrumental version doesn't have any acoustic guitar in it because then it has the vocals in it. So, but then you get to hear the piano and the bass, and the players on the record are phenomenal. My brother William plays the piano throughout it, and Tommy plays the bass and guitar, and Alex Shakur, who played with the Extraordinaires, plays the guitar, and Justin Gwip, who played with Levon Helm, plays the drums, and then Homer plays, and Nick plays, you know, and Leon plays all over the record. The Budos Band horn players play on the record. Same horn players who played on Although We Cry play on Crack of Dawn. Like, it's just a family thing.
That's the Budos Band on?
That's the Budos Band on the horns with Leon and, like, I think Dave Guy, I think the Menahan crew on Although We Cry. I think it's the Menahan crew and the Budos crew, and on Crack of Dawn is the Budos crew.
The sweeping sort of crescendo part of when the horns come in, I think, is part of what gives me that feel. That kind of takes you somewhere. I mean, you're already going somewhere, and then it takes you somewhere else.
Kind of the vibe that ended up happening with this record. It's significantly different sounding than the first record, but I believe I believe it's the best work I've done. I'm sure a ton of people say that, and my new stuff is the best stuff I've done, but there's something about this record that I am so proud of that is so truly me. That is unlike any other record or any of the songs I've ever written. This group of songs, it feels...
It's clearly very personal.
It's extremely personal. Like, it's one of the first times I've put these kinds of things down. Like, these stories, I feel like they're stories that are really... Like, they're stories I lived. It's cool to write other kinds of stuff. I have a hard time writing that kind of thing, but this record in particular,
this record's called So Long.
It is. It's called So Long.
And why is it called So Long?
It's because that was kind of, like I said, there was this thing. I was done with this relationship and this road, but it was such a beautiful journey. But it was like, okay, that's, I have to say goodbye to that. You know,
I mean, I tell you what I can't help but think about as, you know, I know the record and I've listened to it several times. And earlier we're talking about Someone to Someone and what that means. And I'm assuming that song was written before you were involved in this relationship.
It was.
Okay. And now we're at the end of this relationship.
It was.
And we're starting the record with Although We Cry. Right. And I can't help but think of the sentiment in Someone to Someone. And then the sentiment almost at the end of one particular journey, a very important journey. But this very... philosophical perspective of how we deal with loss, because you're embracing the great parts that make the loss painful, right?
Right, right. Right.
And it's just so amazing
you
to
grow
me that this,
from it.
Yeah,
that's who you are. That
right,
you.
You're giving yourself in the form of a record,
kind of, and it's kind of scary. And getting up on stage is kind of intimidating, and.
Giving your soul
to people is really, really, really scary. And to be honest with you, the other night at that show, I wanted to say on the stage, thank you for being so receptive, because getting up here is not easy, and it's not easy. People are performers. You know, Charles Bradley, a performer.
Mm-hmm.
Black Pumas, phenomenal performers.
Yeah, very right.
You know what I mean, those are performers.
Yeah,
that lead man. That oh man,
Eric Burton. Eric's no joke.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Yeah,
that is a front man.
Yeah.
He is a front
man.
He is phenomenal.
I am not a performer. Like, I can't get like in that way where it's like I can separate myself from this thing, but I'm also giving myself, but I can separate it and have this kind of fun and then still give it and still personal, but it's kind of.
But that
for me, it's
that makes you a persona.
Absolutely.
Instead of the performer, you're a persona. You come out there. And it's you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
It is.
It's difficult.
There was something, I mean, I could tell it was difficult.
It is.
But the performance was amazing. And I had a lot of friends around me. And I can't tell, and I told my friends about you. And hey, you've got to check out this record. And it really started me playing them the Charlotte. I was going, can you believe that this is a modern thing? And then listening to your music. But every one of my friends had the same reaction to your set. And it was, oh my God, this is beautiful. And this guy's voice is fucking amazing.
Thanks.
And I knew that you were singing from a place of vulnerability. And I had this, I've always had my dad as a safety net with everything I've done. And I was just, I had this amazing personal feeling when you were explaining a song that was emotional and powerful. And your dad is standing next to you, and I'm watching his body language, and I'm suddenly thinking about my son, and when my son wants to go out in the world. And what did that feel like, William, being on stage with
your son? It's just the greatest. It's the greatest because you're sharing it with him.
Yeah.
And it's an honor to be able to do it because, you know, his stuff is unique. It is personal. You know, we have a relationship with each other also, and it's beautiful being out there. Yeah.
It's awesome.
And
my bodyguard.
You're protecting your soul. Is that what he's doing?
I don't know about that.
I'm a parole officer, but he's my bodyguard.
I had so much fun doing this podcast with Paul and William. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I have to thank my buddy Will over at Josie Records for putting Paul on my radar in the first place. You know, Paul, in 2006, fell in love with the Mavericks when they got screwed by the refs going up against the Miami Heat. He calls it the fix of 06. And he's like, that's a team I can pull for right there. And here we are 13 years later, and he's recording a podcast in Dallas, Texas, with a guy on the Mavs TV broadcast. Pretty cool full circle stuff. Huge thanks to you guys for checking out this podcast. Thanks to Big Crown Records and Daptone Records for letting us use some of the music. Please go and pick up those records. A lot of them available on vinyl, which means a little something to me. It also means a little something to me if you told your friends about this podcast and subscribe to it. That way it can get to your ear holes the second that we release it. Don't forget to listen to the Ben and Skin Show weekdays 3 to 7 on 105.3 The Fan. Thanks to KT for producing this. And as always, thanks to the Jizza for the inspiration.
We had just finished mixing Someone to Someone in the studio.
Wow.
Late night. And Tommy mentioned he had this song. And we're hanging out and he's playing this piano part. And I just start singing over it. And it kind of went the same way as Open My Eyes, where it was like I came up with it just for a minute. He sent me a tape of it, and I kind of worked on some melodies, and we went in and did it just on our phone, kind of messing around, like, you know, late night, really, really late. And then again gave it to Pop and let him do his thing with it, like really take over it.
So much to do with it. It's so great.
And that's kind of how it went. And then that one became kind of like a duet as well. But Pop worked in all these other backing vocals, like all everybody the Thomas for Will and for Carmine. That's kind of how our songs go when we do them together, man.
And I think those are the best songs, the ones that start one place, end somewhere else.
I don't know about that, man. I don't know. Love in the Wind is phenomenal. Duet is phenomenal. Okay, My Love. Okay, My Love is
Okay, My Love has a strange story to it. Also, is that he began that Tommy began that hook. I think he said 10 years ago.
He just started. He wrote that when he was on the road with Sharon. He wrote that actually talking to his mother.
Yes. Okay, My Love, I'll be home soon.
Yeah, you're right.
Hey, Tommy, I said, I never got a chance to finish this up. Is there anything you can do with it? All right, but again, if somebody else starts it. You know, they put you on a road that you would not otherwise have traveled.
Yeah.
And it's great to go down that road.